Hello, the internet, and welcome to season 200, episode one of Der Daily Zeitgeist.
Yeah!
I feel like that's one of those things that other shows would have like a whole plan for, and I just realized it was season 200 when I just read that.
Hey, you know what? But that's what we do. We clock in.
That is what we do.
Get our heads down, we clock out, put another banner up. 200 banners.
This is a production of iHeartRadio, and it's a podcast where we take a deep dive into America's shared consciousness. It is Monday, August 30th, 2021. My name is Jack O'Brien, a.k.a. I host the Daily Zeitgeist with my very white thighs and my co-host Miles. That is supposed to be Alive by P.O.D., which they're a Christian band, apparently.
Oh, yeah.
Did not realize that.
Oh, you didn't?
I did.
Are you a fan, bro?
Huge. And I never realized it. I thought those were love songs. Anyways, I'm thrilled to be joined, as always, by my co-host, Mr. Miles Gray!
Yes, it's Miles Gray. I've just not been on social media much, but we're just going to do this one because I check the news all the damn time. I look at what's trending to make reason and rhyme. Ooh. Smoking hot takes. I've had a few. I sold the Squarespace and a Toshiba day while sipping on news and ripping a bong. It's Daily Zeitgeist, my friend. Where Miles will cover the trends. It's Daily Zeitgeist. It's Daily Zeitgeist. Fuck the Fox Newsers, cause the Daily Zeitgeist. Anyway, look.
You just made that up?
No. That came from the brew on Discord. I like how I just rolled into it. I'm like, I don't know what to do. Oh, you know what? Fuck it.
Here's a 2 minute.
Like, holy shit. How did he do
that? That was great.
Anyway, shout out to the brew.
Shout out to everybody who came out Wednesday night. Yeah. That was a total blast. I'm still recovering. Let's just say
cold brew had
me like awake all night.
Yeah.
Yeah, but if you're a Crofton fan and you missed it, I don't know what to tell you. If you want to see Miles wearing the finest fashions of the year 2000 NBA draft, you want to see me dressed as like a member of LFO. Is that the name of the band?
You're like the guy who auditioned for LFO. You're on the fringes of getting in. Yeah.
With a soul patch. Yeah, go. You can still watch the VOD at momenthouse.com/thedailyzeitgeist. But shout out to everybody who was there in person.
Thank you for joining us on this journey.
Yeah. Well, we are thrilled to be joined by the very funny and talented writer and podcaster who you can hear on the wonderful NBA Baseline podcast. And his new podcast, Never Meet Your Heroes, in which he tells you all the most shocking details and twists and turns from celebrity backstories like Mark Wahlberg, Shia LaBeouf. We'll have to ask him if he included Miles Gray's rap group in that backstory. Also Michael Jordan. He's one of the best followers on Twitter. Please welcome back to the show, Jabari Ali Davis!
Hey guys, I appreciate you having me again. I'm not going to lie to you. I've already made the determination. I'm never going to outdo you guys with the intro. So my AKA is a coworker last week told me you're exactly like Suge Knight, except for nice. And I guess what they really mean, because I've been told this many times before, is you're a big black guy with a shaved head. So that's cool.
Wow.
And you got a beard too.
And I do have a beard.
So Suge Knight. That's a good.
Yeah. Suge Knight. Kind of AKA cool. Suge Knight.
It was right there. It was right, and no one was stealing that.
Right. You know what you got to do, though. You'd be like, oh, I'm like Suge, and you hold their ass over the edge of a building.
Right, give me your royalties right now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Fuck around. You think that you're fucking stereotypical bullshit.
Remind me another time. I'll tell you a story about signing up for that man's big hit song at karaoke there in the valley, and he walked out because he was upset.
Oh,
wait,
wow.
What? He was at the karaoke bar?
Ireland 32s, it's a spot that's over there. I think, what is it, like Burbank, or not Burbank, like Van Nuys or whatnot. I was there, you know, Rob Van Winkle? Vanilla Ice was there. He was in the back. He's having a good time. Folks are showing him love. So I figured, hey, look, we're here. We're going to go ahead and do this. I signed up for it. The song came on. He gets up and walks out because, like, I guess he was offended by it, but whatever.
Wow.
Because you did Ice Baby?
Yeah. It's like, bro, this is what we know you from.
Yeah, oh, I thought like, it what was the fuck did you expect? That song, Have You Ever Made Love in an Inner Tube by Vanilla Ice off of To the Extreme.
Is that a song?
That's not the title, but he talks about making love in an inner tube, which is like the sort of thing that a middle school student, which I was at the time, or I think elementary actually, would like think was cool. Like,
yeah,
anybody who's ever had sex would be like, that sounds really like uncomfortable and difficult. Yeah,
you got to come from tubing culture, not Jeffrey right. Tubin, but inner tubing, and embrace your inner tubing while you're inner tubing, as Vanilla Ice would.
Yeah. All right, Jabari, we're going to get to know you a little bit better. Oh, first, I do want to ask to hit us with a detail from the backstories of what one of the celebrities you've covered on the show. Anything that surprised you?
Honestly, during the Michael Jordan episode, and you know, for anybody that you know that does take a chance to listen to it, I'll admit the first couple of episodes we were still finding our footage, but I feel like we've done that. But during the Jordan episode, we had a really good conversation surrounding kind of the coverage, the when he retired with his father's death and all of that. Even though, I lived through it and I was, I was old enough to be aware. It was interesting to me. It's kind of like, I'm sure if you haven't seen the Malice in the Palace, Malice in the Palace documentary on Netflix.
Yeah, not yet. I'm watching it this weekend.
Strongly recommend it. Remember all of the things. I was there when those things were said. But sometimes when you hear it, from 1,000 miles out, it's like, oh, wow. Right. Okay. So,
yeah.
But in terms of crazy stuff about celebrities, none of it's really going to shock you. We've always kind of known that.
Right. There you go.
What you're about.
He keeps there recently. Why did I see this thing trending on like NBA Reddit again when they were talking when Charles Barkley was bringing up that anecdote about how like Michael Jordan has no empathy for like the unhoused when he's like, don't give him that money. If he can say, can I get some change? He can say, welcome to McDonald's. Can I take your order? And you're like, oh, my God, Michael, I wouldn't expect anything fucking less. But Jesus.
I don't know if he really said it, but like you just said, it wouldn't shock me. It would not shock me.
But now he's come around. That's why I'm like now since the pandemic, he's been so philanthropic. Like I'm really curious to even hear from him, like if he sees himself as having an evolution, because he knows he was a fierce guy, and we saw that he knows he has some level of self awareness. But I'm curious if he's like, I've learned to love more.
He had to have. Honestly, he had to have because, while obvious he was doing things throughout his career, we certainly didn't hear about it. And he definitely was never going to, take a stance, not a public stance, especially that would be controversial. Over the last 5 years or so, I feel like he's definitely moved towards at least showing that he's, he's about the right things.
Right. Yeah. I wonder if The Last Dance, because that was basically controlled by him, or at least he
definitely.
Was the one who was like, okay, we can make this now. I wonder if just, seeing it through new eyes or having other people see him and like that whole, experience was kind of gave him a new perspective.
Right.
The detail, I thought you were going to say Charles Barkley talked about when he was like, I hate that fat fuck, but like, he's never going to he's never going to outplay me in this final series again. Which that was wild. Like that was like a next level of pathology that like I knew he was a competitor like to a pathological degree. I didn't know it was like that.
Right.
We did an episode where we touched on Chuck a little bit. Do you guys remember that arrest that he had, stemming from about probably like 10 years ago, in Phoenix, just outside of Phoenix?
Vaguely. Chuck D?
Charles
Barkley.
We're close enough Chuck to where D. he's Chuck to me. It's either Round Mound or Chuck. It's really D. not Charles. Anymore.
Yeah. No, I do remember that where he was like driving fast and said he had to go somewhere to get a blowjob, I think.
Yep. My man had like donuts in the seat next to him and said, hey, I was just, just going out to get a blowjob. But anyhow, there you have it. That's Chuck
there
for
it
you.
Is.
Just going out for one, casual.
And you, of course, did cover Shia's early rap career and his partnership with Miles Gray, right?
Well, that was a long time. We have nothing to do with his bullshit now. So it's not trying to get me caught up with this
Miles,
shit
right now. I kind of need to know. Honestly, we're both Valley boys. You're a little bit younger than me. You would have come up around that time. What is the connection there with Shia? And no offense if I offended you on the episode, because I did.
No, not like that. I mean, look, in high school, I was friends with a lot of kids who were on the Disney Channel. specifically this guy, Mike Galeota, rest in peace. He used to be on the show called The Jersey. And we were really tight. We were super tight. And through Mike, I met all these other people who were on the Disney Channel. And like, we were all like weed smokers and they were like white kids who wanted to be black. So it
was like life in the valley.
Start a rap group. And it was like us and a bunch of other kids, like younger siblings of people that were on the Disney Channel. Some just other like local kids. And it was called the Element Crew. And I think that shit's on SoundCloud somewhere. But
wow.
I will be going to look it up. I will absolutely.
Yeah. I'll drop a link somewhere sometime.
Fantastic. All right. Well, we are going to get to know you a little bit better in a moment. First, we're going to tell our listeners a couple of things we're talking about today. We're going to talk about the selective empathy of America, how the Supreme Court is making that official with some of their recent decisions. We'll talk about the legal drama behind McDonald's ice cream machines, why those are always out of order. We'll talk about J.R. Smith's journey. It's been very fun to follow on Twitter. And a new Fortnite feature, all of that, plenty more. But first, Jabari, we like to ask our guests, what is something from your search history?
Well, you kind of already let the cat out of the bag. I was going to shamelessly, you know, note this. Political scandals, you know, and it's for the show, like you mentioned, you know, Never Meet Your Heroes. You know, as you mentioned, we've done, you know, Michael Jordan, Shia LaBeouf, Mark Wahlberg, you know, a bunch of other people, you know, for season one. But right now I'm knee deep in, you know, basically Anthony Weiner type stuff at the moment.
Oh, wow.
Got it.
Anthony Weiner type stuff. So just like a lot of dick pics or actually
a little, you know, honestly, no pun intended, a little bit of that, yeah. and some lesser known stuff, from folks.
Yeah. I remember that he I think he was like roommates with Jon Stewart or something. So I was like, Anthony Weiner fucking rules, man. Like that was where I got all my politics from at that stage.
That's why I fucked with Al Gore, because he was Tommy Lee Jones' roommate.
Yeah,
and
you do take all your political cues from. Yeah.
Well, that and like it all because, you know, when I was a kid, I was just obsessed with celebrity birthdays, like who had the same birthday as me. So when it was Tommy Lee Jones, I was like, oh, shit, I like Men in Black. And then I'm like, this tracks. And then I was like, then my mom's like, they were roommates. I'm like, all right, Al Gore. All right, homie. Yeah, thanks for inventing the internet. Good luck, bro.
It's nice to see that we all do that as kids, by the way, not to take it off, but, you know, just going with it. Morgan Freeman and Marilyn Monroe were, you know, the ones that I was, happy about. June 1st, what's up?
That's really good. That's a real, that spectrum. I like that.
I may have even lied to people and said, like, yeah, Morgan Freeman, I'm related to him, as though there's some connection when you have the same birthday as someone.
I tell people I am Prince Harry. Because we have the exact same birthday. So there's not, what's the problem here?
I can believe it.
I might as well be the same person. What about you, Jack? Who you got?
I was like, I must not have like been into that when I was young. But I think it turns out I just don't have anyone good to claim. I've got, get ready. So Maya Rudolph is by far, far and away
Maya
the best.
Rudolph, okay.
I've also got Bill Ingvall.
All right.
So that's cool.
Comedy powerhouse.
Different spectrum. Different
age. Triple H.
Okay, comedy.
Triple H.
Hunter Hearst Helmsley. Okay.
Hey, that counts. Hey, that's a good one.
That was before my time. I was before. Like
you were fucking with DX.
Yeah. This was 95. Okay. He came out and I wasn't into. But the dude, Jamie Lannister from. It's just like there's nobody that I would have been into when I was a kid, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Damn.
Yeah.
Pretty. When I was a kid, these are the ones that I remember. Peggy Fleming Jenkins, U.S. Olympic figure skater. And there's also like another Olympic skater, Christopher Dean. Those were the ones and Jerry Van Dyke, who I didn't really know much about. So, you know, you guys, that's your celebrity birthday privilege of having great celebrity birthdays. And it must be nice.
You know, who else I got? I got Tom Hardy. No, I got Marco Polo.
What?
I got Jenna Marbles from YouTube, if you remember that fucking shit.
I don't think I do.
Yo, there's... Oh, my God. No way. There's someone on Instagram called Young Blasian, and we have the same birthday.
What?
Okay, Young... Okay, so you,
I feel like
child,
this is the
Young
last
Blasian.
Scene of Fight Club where we realize that you and Young Blasian are the same person.
I'm a 22-year-old Instagram.
You are Young Blasian.
You've had created a separate personality. Where, right.
Ben Schwartz, too?
Damn, man.
Look at God. You know what? It makes sense, though, too, because it's mating season. So, many people, like, you just, it's condensed right here in August, September and shit, too. So.
Yeah. My parents were gross having sex around fucking October. Bunch of freaky Halloween.
Just nasty, rotten punk baby sex.
Halloween baby.
Halloween baby.
Come on.
Lisa Vanderpump. I mean, come on. Get off me. Get off me.
This is.
Agatha Christie. Come on. Back up. Back up.
What is something you think is overrated, Jabari?
Overrated. We're going there first. All right. I actually took notes this time. Alternative cauliflower products. And I'm going to say it with my chest. For the record, I'm not one of those that, you know, I don't shame people for what they enjoy. You know, I'm not going to yuck your yum if that's your thing.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm generally here to give something a shot, especially if you tell me that it has like some healthy property, you know, a health benefit. I'm at that age and general health status where I'm like, oh, it's good for me and it tastes good. Okay, cool. I'll eat it. I'm not here for the, you know, for the, you know, for the cauliflower. I've never had a product that actively tasted good.
Wow.
The cauliflower products. Have you had cauliflower that you enjoy?
Wait, what?
I won't lie. I don't love just regular cauliflower either.
Right.
But okay. I am at that age where it's like, you got to eat your vegetables. You got to do these things. You have to, you have to make these adjustments. And I just cruciferous
veggies. Wait, so what alternatives are you talking about? Like cauliflower
rice, cauliflower crust, cauliflower anything? Like,
I had something
that someone called buffalo, like, you know, a buffalo nugget. It was halfway decent because it was sauced like crazy and, you know, butter and sugar, but
like deep fried and shit.
Yeah, I just can't get with it. So, I say this as someone, I'll admit, I got into Trader Joe's late. In fact, I got into Trader Joe's late specifically because I thought it was Whole Foods, because most of the people that I saw going in and out of there pretty much look like, you know, Whole Foods folks, just with dirtier sandals. And then I realized, hey, man, I've been missing out, man. Trader Joe's is a haven for, you know, for people of my, you know, desires. But just not with the cauliflower.
And so. Cheap, too. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
So you should have known those dirtier sandals, man. You saw the class struggle right there.
Yeah.
Growing up in the valley, you don't know. You just don't know. You know, dirty sandals and pooper shells, they might be getting into the rings, you know?
Yeah. Hey, lay off pooper
shells. I stopped going. And then I just recently started going. Mostly I stopped going because in the pandemic, it was always a fucking line out there.
Everybody.
And
yeah.
I'm like,
standing outside the building. Yeah, that was.
Yeah, like in the rain and shit. I'm like, I just want popsicles. Like,
kind of, yeah.
I'll go into Ralph's. I'm sorry.
Well, we back now. We back.
Yeah,
no more lines.
I just got a bag of onion garlic pistachios from. Oh, my. I almost ate the whole fucking bag and I had to like stop myself.
Yeah.
Ooh. Anyway,
it's a problem.
Yeah.
A flavored pistachio is one of the best snacks.
It's what
salted pistachio in general, but all pistachios.
They have salt and pepper. They have like chile and lime. They have all kinds of fucking flavors. That's, you know what? Do you, TJ. I see you.
I watched my kids discover the joys of like peeling pistachios and then like eating them and just had a whole new appreciation. It was like one of those things where it's like, they were like, this is amazing.
We're vegan crawfish.
Yeah.
They're going to grow up and see that they could have been having them shelled the whole time and call you a broke boy.
Yeah, no, that's true.
You know what's okay. Would you buy that though? Cause I was faced with that decision when I was at the store. Like, do I buy just straight for the nut meat? Or am I about the process? Okay.
Right. And I was like the process.
Immediately I was like, no, man, the whole point is to fucking rip them open and shit and throw them in a bowl and whatever. Yeah. Anyway.
A Naked Gun joke where they got the pistachio shells outside of the stakeout.
Just piling up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What is something you think is underrated?
All right. So I plan to go with something like really mature sounding this time and, you know, like actively, you know, being kind to others, you know, especially given the times and circumstances, but, you know, and offering compassion and kindness to folks in need. Those are things that we should be doing. But I decided that your listeners and listeners to a show like this, they already know those things. And honestly, I don't need to beat them over the head with the reality. So I'm going to take a quick moment to do a bootleg Anna Jose streaming corner. Please forgive me for this one. And I'm going to defend a show and even mention another one. Ozark. Here we go. I promise you.
Underrated.
I don't want beef with Francesca Fiorentini. And please, I hope I said that right. Wonderful guest. I don't want any beef. But I'm going to tell you right now. Yes, it's the Midwest version of Breaking Bad. And I'm not, you know, there's no way around it. You know, sure, it's a bit repetitive in the same ways as shows, you know, of that nature tend to be with, you know, kind of with forced drama and continued family trauma, you know, at least from that perspective. But it's unique enough in the way they break things down, especially in seasons 1 and 2, I just feel obligated to defend those of us that are, you know, still actively watching just about anything and everything. Because I'm honestly, Miles, you were saying this all throughout the pandemic, and I recognize there are some people that are no longer living in one, even though we are still in one. For me, right. I'm watching everything. So honestly, Ozark is not the end of it.
Okay. You're in the airplane. Everything's the airplane.
Everything.
It's worth watching, and you watch it to completion.
For example, I'm currently watching Wu Assassins on Netflix. You know, it's absolutely not my usual genre of shows. You know, it's action-adventure with pretty inexplicably bad graphics at times, but here we are. You know, chances are, if you can string together two consecutive decent episodes, I'm going to give it a shot.
Okay. Wait, so what, because my thing with Ozark, I couldn't get probably the third episode in. It just wasn't doing it for me, so I stopped three episodes in. Because this is the same thing that people said with Mad Men. They're like, you got to get through like the first five, the first eight. I'm like, I don't want to get through. But, and this might be another thing too, where I'm willing to just, for me personally, I don't know. Maybe it's not the same show, but I'm not trying to say unequivocally it's trash.
It's not the same show, but again, I do recognize that criticism. I would say this. Anything that anyone tells me generally, you know, like, oh, you just have to get through it. I'm usually one of those people. It's like, well, then it probably sucks. But, you know, for this one, they do a decent enough job. And again, you know, seasons one and two, they do a decent enough job in making the characters somewhat redeemable to where you actually buy into them, to where there is that, you know, there is that buy in. But, you know, like for you know, I know there's folks that simply they're never going to like, oh, my goodness, the main character.
Jason Bateman.
There's certain people that are just never going to like him, and I recognize that. So if he's not
your game, I like him. That's the reason I even gave it a shot, because I loved Arrested Development, and I'm just like, yeah, I'm willing to go on this journey with Jason as he figures out his acting.
I would say, you know what, I am a little bit biased. You know, Kevin L. Johnson, an actor, he's been in a bunch of stuff. I've interviewed him a couple times on different shows that I've done. You know, he plays a character on the show, you know, so I'm always going to, you know, kind of want positive things for it. But, I genuinely enjoy it.
All right. Well, that is the sort of thing we need to hear in our underrated, you know, let people feel okay about something that other people have been, because I feel like I have not heard a positive take on Ozark in a long time. So that's great to hear. I might just give it a chance.
It's also because season three, they just kind of went off the deep end, and I'll openly admit their characterization of what bipolar disorder looks like is really offensive to those of us that suffer from bipolar disorder.
Right.
So if people have that complaint, I 100% get it. Because that's legitimate.
Yeah. All right. Let's take a quick break and we'll be right back. And we're back. And we're just going to do like a general check-in with the state of America. But before we do, we were realizing before we started recording, Jabari, that the last time you were on was January 5th. It's been kind of an uneventful 8 months since then. Yeah. So the day before the insurrection, you were on here last. So I'm just warning people, you know, watch out for tomorrow, Tuesday. We'll see what happens.
Don't sleep on the influence of Suge Knight. Don't sleep on the influence.
Exactly.
Grow with the gravitational pull of Jupiter.
There you go.
There you go. But Miles, you were kind of, you put together some thoughts on just sort of this idea of America's practice of selective empathy.
Yeah. Like, you know, like just like last time with the media not talking about Afghanistan in one way, like now I look at, you know, with the conversation talking about resettling Afghan refugees, I was just, you know, seeing how the momentum was moving very swiftly, you know, because there's about 88,000 Afghans that assisted, you know, the occupying American and allied forces during the Forever War. And now the U.S. is like obviously scrambling to relocate these people to fulfill a moral obligation since, you know, like leaving them and their family members behind in a place as the Taliban is like trying to have retaliatory attacks against these people is what should be done on a minimum level, if not more people. And then you look at the polling, right? Americans are pretty much on the same page. Like 90% of Democrats, 76% of Republicans are saying like, yeah, I'm not opposed to resettling these people in America, and understand like apparently that the narrative is they helped the army. So they should just, like, that's their ticket to the United States. And another story I read about these South Florida Republicans who were very enthusiastic about welcoming these people. And I don't have any opposition to the fact that they're open, that they feel, you know, aligned with this sentiment. But it just says, like, a lot, right? Because, like, at a minimum, it acknowledges that these people put themselves and their loved ones in harm's way to help the United States military. And they understand, like, the reciprocal nature of this transaction. Like, that's okay. We get it. Y'all all could have got fucked up helping the U.S., our, you know, brave men and women out there. So this, you know, equates to a ticket back. But on, like, this other way, it just sort of underlines this fucked up way in which Americans choose to have empathy for displaced people. Like, if you are working in service of the American war machine, then it's a no brainer that, right. You know, like, oh, man, like, you, like, because then it's like you were one of the good ones. You know what I mean? Like, we came, fucked up your country. You still helped out. You know what? That's worth a ticket back here. We thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And then, you know, and then even though, like, normally the narrative around Afghan refugees, like, on Fox has basically been terribly Islamophobic and xenophobic and, you know, ethno-nationalist.
Yeah.
But 76% of Republicans feel that it is our duty as Americans to take these people in. And I'm just like, what the fuck? What does this say about every other situation that we're involved in that intersects with the United States foreign policy and displacement of people and even domestic policy and displacement of people? That where does it's amazing to see how people can just selectively be like, yep, those people deserve empathy. Those people at the border, not so much. I mean, granted that you can draw straight lines from American foreign policy and intervention in Latin America to why we have this immigration problem. And on the same level, if it's like, well, these people are displaced because you get cheap fruit for fucking dole or whatever, that there's no empathy. There's no understanding of what the root causes are. And it's just kind of, you know, I'm just sitting there thinking, right, here's another example of all that.
Right. It's where. I wonder if it's because the cheap fruit is, like, you know, it's implicating the consumer. You know, it kind of gets mm-hmm. at this undercurrent where it's like, yeah, all of this is being done to just feed the kind of massive consuming machine that America has instead of a soul. And we don't want to acknowledge that.
Right. And if you go just slightly broader, right, the fruit is, like, one dimension, because the whole point of fighting all these, like, all the intervention in Latin America was the way the U.S. was fighting the Cold War.
Right.
Communism. The whole thing was like, do not let communism root on the continent, and we'll do whatever the fuck we have to do by hook or by crook to figure out how to stop that momentum. So on some level, you could argue that this was happening to protect America's freedom, right? Like, that rhetoric is sort of that, like, or logic was being applied. Yet again, we look at displaced people from there and go, oh, that's your problem. That's right. Your problem.
Well, I mean, really, it has always felt like the cutoff, and it's very clear at this stage, especially over these last couple of years, the cutoff is, like, do we feel like these people have, you know, have value to us? Do we? And I'm not saying the three of us. I'm not saying, like, you know, those of us that actually have natural empathy. But I'm saying, you know, the general public, oftentimes it seems like if we don't feel like, you know, there's value, monetary, actual value to you, then it doesn't matter. And that's more telling about, you know, about society, because, you know, and it's not just how we look at people in foreign lands, it's how we look at people in America. If you are poor, you ain't shit. You know, like if you're not out there contributing to the, you know, to this system, then you're not worth our time. So,
And I get, though, too, you know, a big difference is with Afghanistan and, you know, everything that happened in 9/11. There was just, you know, nonstop. It was a primetime TV conflict for a certain point. And so people, and there was countless TV shows, you know, and films that were, like, talking about, like, what's happening over in the Middle East and things like that post 9/11, that was a thing that people had just, like, this sort of concept of. But there isn't much talking about American intervention in other places and things like that. And but then I'm like, okay, well, maybe it's a historical thing, right? Like, because people know what's going on in Afghanistan, and, like, they're like, okay, well, that I understand why we need to extend empathy there, even though truly it's not even, it's only being extended to 88,000 people among millions in the region.
Right.
But it's the same thing with like Black Americans. We fucking built this country, right? And the land was stolen from indigenous people. Yet these groups are still like, I don't know what the fuck y'all problem is.
Right.
What is going on? And so it's like sickening to watch how certain issues that deal with things that are happening within the country and are so clear of like why we need to correct things, you know, but there's just not the energy for that. Yet for these things, there's just a lot of media momentum. And Americans can selectively say, like, right, I totally understand why we need to, our obligation to resettle these refugees. Yet we still are unable to look at all these myriad of ways that we're connected to other struggles and problems within the country and outside and still not be compelled.
Because it's easy to turn a blind eye and the next thing will come up and we'll all obsess about that. I actually have to, honestly... Y'all know, like, I appreciate shows like this. I appreciate Ethnically Ambiguous and, like those wonderful ladies, Anna and both Anna and Shireen, for pointing stuff like this out, whether it's on, whether it's on the shows, whether it's on, whether it's on the timeline. And actually, through conversations with Anna in particular, like she was the one who pointed out, like, we as a country, we definitely pick and choose. We definitely pick and choose what's going to matter, who's going to matter, how much it's going to matter. And we really can't do that. I say we really can't do that. Yes, we can, but we obviously really shouldn't, because look at where we're at.
Right.
Yeah.
And this whole thing is just about preserving, like you say, we're selective about where we choose to understand what's at stake or what the consequences were for other people based on certain policies. And then the second we try to inform people, right, of like history, we see what happens. It's just met with rage and violence because it's, the ignorance is intended to sort of preserve this American sense of moral purity. And with Afghanistan, I think it gives people a really easy thing to be like, yep, there was a war there. These people are basically, they fought on this team, so they get to come on back on the bus back to the locker room after the game kind of mentality. But the second it begins to really sort of intersect with something a little more like closer to home or something that you may actually have to think about deeper than just merely this like very clean sort of logic path, then it becomes chaotic and things like that. And it's fucked up because there's countless ways that people are being left behind, whether it's in the Middle East, in South Asia, wherever. But we chug along on this path and like we only see things get worse. So I'm just kind of thinking like, what does it take? Because if it's not about connecting people to the history to understand sort of like the U.S.'s place in that, what will do it?
Yeah, there's... Americans seem particularly bad at feeling empathy towards poor people in our own country because I think they're, I talk on here a lot about like just the work, the like psychological work that needs to be done for the passive white supremacists in the country to just like go about their daily lives and like kind of push down whatever that reality is, whatever realities are hitting them, like whether it's somebody living on the street or, the videos of police shooting innocent people of color. Like there's just so much work that's having to be done for them to like block that out. And so by letting in empathy for anybody in the country already, you're almost having to admit like that whole thing is on shaky foundation. Whereas I feel like the Afghanistan war and the Iraq war, the media and the American people were able to like kind of think of it as a thing that was separate from them. And right. So that's enabling them. And then, the specifics of the really shocking and horrifying footage from the airport, especially in those early days, I think like probably just crystallized things in the kind of American consciousness.
Which is wild, though, too, because there's so many people that are destitute here.
Yeah.
And it's just this, it's like we just want to put our eyes on the thing that feels like it can be solved in that one thing. Oh, yeah. The Afghanistan thing can be solved if we get enough people on planes and then it's over and I'll have to think about it and it's done. I look at, you look at things that happen on the streets of any city, Philadelphia, Baltimore, New York, LA, wherever, there's real problems. And it's much easier, I guess, to go down that path to think of how we can solve that is just too much of a task for some people to engage in mentally, when most of it really is just about being like, no one's asking you to solve it, but like, fuck, man, have the same feeling for that. If your heart's broken seeing people who are clinging to, you know, trying to escape their country to get here, and you can somewhat understand like, oh yeah, I get that. Just open your heart a little bit. You know what I mean? To be able to have that sort of same level of compassion for more people. But I don't know. That's me being like, what's wrong with us?
But it also feels like all of this is, you know, very, very specifically by design. Like, for instance, there's a reason why we didn't ever see the footage of, you know, like what was going on in Afghanistan. There's a reason why we didn't see the body counts. There's a reason why they didn't even keep track in a lot of, you know, in a lot of situations. Mm-hmm. There's and the same thing goes where, you know, domestically, individuals are no longer seen as individuals. If we just call them gangs, or we say that it's gang violence, instead of saying like, these are people, these are Americans that are, you know, that are suffering, that are in terrible situations, that are, you know, innocent, you know, beyond beliefs in a lot of situations, it's easy to just ignore. It's easy to, you know, like, you know, to look past people. Like it's mm-hmm. the same thing. You pull up, you put, let's say you're getting off the freeway, you're getting off the 405. There's a dude sitting there right there waiting for money. It's real easy for folks to roll that window up, turn the music mm-hmm. up, and look forward. Right. That's what we've always done.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know, like, on some level, like, you know, it's a feeling of shame or powerlessness. Like, someone, you know, depending on how you process it. At times, like, for me, it's like a feeling of shame, like, fuck, man, like, I can't, like, this, I feel so helpless that there's this person who's my age, who is, we're probably coming from very similar circumstances, and this is how things shake up, because this is how things are, you know, sort of designed in the country. Yeah, it's just, and I think it can be overwhelming for a lot of people on some level, too, but it's just like this sort of very, it's like one of the many superpowers that Americans and American media have created to sort of keep the status quo going in this direction, which is one that doesn't really care for people that are marginalized or in need of help. Just yeah. focus on the people who got it.
Right. So just kind of in a related story, kind of more specifically, the way the Supreme Court interacts with this. The Supreme Court last week made two, like, what are being called shadow docket decisions. I guess this is when the president kind of forces an issue onto their desk that's like, this needs immediate attention. When the Trump administration was doing that, they were siding with the Trump administration a lot more. It's basically a decision where they don't have to, like, write out full decisions. They just, like, make a decision on it. And, like, in one of the cases here, it was a two-paragraph decision. So these were the first ones that Biden kind of pushed through to their desk in the Biden administration. And in both cases, the Supreme Court ruled to basically side with the Trump administration. Biden was trying to reverse a Trump policy that was forcing people to stay in Mexico if they had asylum claims at the border, and is just, you know, using pure technicalities. The six conservatives on the Supreme Court basically made the decision that the conservatives of the country would want to, which is, you know, just have no empathy for them, keep them in Mexico, not our problem. Again, like,
that wasn't even the policy.
Yeah, no, they've moved the field goals, like, back, mm-hmm. or the goalposts is the word that I was looking for. I think there's a, when we talk about the Supreme Court, especially in the mainstream media, I feel like there is this sense that they are like these theoreticians who are like operating in a void, and like, it's just, we're just sitting back to like, wait to see what these like legal supercomputers decide is the most just thing. But as we've talked about, like, you know, intelligence gives you, like, really highly intelligent people have the ability to make a strong argument for whatever the fuck they want to believe. That's mm-hmm. why highly intelligent people are more likely to be in cults. And that's why this whole idea of the Supreme Court, like, the Supreme Court could come up with a seemingly logically coherent case for anything they wanted to, literally anything, using like previous precedent, because they're like the world's best at arguing for shit. Like that's what that's what they do. So I like, this is a political vehicle, which is why the other shadow docket case that they ended the eviction moratorium that Biden was trying to extend, as we've talked about, that is a horrifying example of just America's ability to not feel empathy for the people around them.
Right. Well, the Constitution, I don't know if the founding fathers were thinking about this. So, you know what, we'll side with the landlords on this one. And now, you know, luckily a lot of states have their own moratoriums and things like that, but this is still putting hundreds of thousands of people at risk.
Oh yeah.
Of eviction. And we're already seeing, and it's already happening, because people are doing it in other ways that aren't your traditional ways of evicting. It might be like, oh, it's time to renew your lease. They're not going to renew it for for this, that, and the other. And that's how they're getting to be able to oust people and then hike the rates up and then bring in other people who are, I guess, making just enough more to justify their, you know, exorbitant rent increases and things.
Yeah.
So not to be like depressing, but like basically what I've gotten out of this conversation thus far is that, yeah, we just don't care as Americans. You know, we don't care. You know, we do not care about employees. We do not care about, you know, workers' rights. We don't care about, you know, so if someone ends up, you know, being out on the street, we don't care about, you know, the unhoused. It's just kind of across the board. That's what it feels like.
And it's true of many other countries, but in here it's like this done to this degree that is so aggressive and like in your face that it's really hard to wrap your head around. And I think the sooner people can understand like that, that's actually kind of like the tone of how this country works. It helps you to sort of redouble your efforts to realize, okay, I need to actually be on the side of people. Yeah. Like, I don't know why the fuck I'm caping for fucking Nancy Pelosi. Like, these people are going to do shit for us.
Yeah.
Like, that's why you look more and you see like in your neighborhoods, people put out, you know, like unperishable food items on the corner just to help support you. Look, if you need, it's free food right here. If you're hungry, like come through, dig in here. There's shit to eat. That's really how you can sort of lift people up, because waiting, you know, for the Supreme Court or Joe Biden to do the right thing, it's just going to lead to more fucking chaos. And I think that's the thing, like when Tory was on talking about dual power and ideas like that, is that Americans really need to begin to embrace that. Most Americans do have empathy. Most Americans, like your neighbors, you're like, damn, man, like they're fucking cool. Like I didn't really talk to them, but something happened and like we got together and we sorted something out. That was great. I have community. You saw it in Texas when the power ran out. A lot of Texans were having to lean on each other to get through it because fucking damn sure the utility companies weren't going to help and make things, you know, quick and expedient for their recovery. So on that level, like we know those pieces are there, but It's like embracing this idea, too, that there are ways that we can collectively take care of each other and protect each other in a way that is beneficial to everyone. And we're not waiting on the decisions of a bureaucracy that's being run by people that are grandparents' age, who we look at our own damn grandparents like, oh, I don't know shit.
Yeah.
But their classmates are running the country, basically.
Right.
And we're like wondering, like, I wonder why nothing's working, because we have. It's and because that mentality that like, hey, everything's okay, nothing's wrong, that may have worked when there were greater tax revenues to help people, but we're in a different era now, and that kind of thinking is just so regressive and it's violent. So it's like getting people really motivated enough to see like, yeah, you can see this place for what it is, not get totally blackpilled, but then pivot to, well, what's the solution?
Yeah.
The solution is finding, like, having policies that are more humane, like, and on some level. The first thing should be like, it's a pandemic. Well, no one should go hungry and no one should be kicked out on the street because it's a pandemic. But here we're arguing in court. It's like, well, the CDC doesn't have the legal authority. Well, what the fuck are we talking about? We're talking about people on the street.
Yeah.
But we're not having a conversation like in those terms. And that's the kind, like, that's where we need to recenter a lot of things. But that's the process of, I think, of waiting for these kind of generational shifts in our political culture.
Yeah. I mean, the Supreme Court, like, dual power needs to be the answer, because the Supreme Court is like purely an ideological tool and it's going to be doing things in the background for generations to come that hurt Americans and, you know, keep it out of step with the will of the people, assuming nothing changes and they don't fucking kill the filibuster and pack the court like they absolutely should. But one very frustrating development is that Stephen Breyer, one of the older members of the court, one of the three left-leaning justices, is choosing to be loyal to that like understanding of the court as like a impartial living embodiment of the scales of justice statue, and is not retiring because he claims that all the justices, he said, act in good faith in his career. That's
you're
what he's
old.
Saying.
You're old. You're fucking old, and you're not seeing. I don't mean to be ageist or anything like that, but like, you're not looking at the country at the same lens that the millions of people who are going to be living on this planet and this country are looking at it too. And it's like this, they're like, we're holding on to these romantic ideas of a time that were also really fucked up for most other people.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, anyway, so I'm sorry. All that, I don't mean to get upset at Justice Breyer or the our elders.
I do. Like, fucking hurry the fuck up. Get out of there. So to prevent further catastrophe.
He's like, I don't want to die while having this job. So he definitely, like, I mean, I also read that, I don't know, maybe there's a chance that he'll figure it out, or people should start screaming at him.
Can I say the quiet part? Like, we don't need another situation like we have with RBG.
Yeah, no, exactly.
That's really what it is. Like, bro, if you're feeling it, get on out.
Yeah.
Whether on, bro, or go, not go, you're go. Feeling it, get the fuck out. Like, that's just, yes.
Well, which is why, we need massive change here, too. Because if all of these, like, decisions that impact millions of people and whether or not they have a home fall to a group of fucking blue plate dinner special motherfuckers who are like, oh, well, let's see. I'm clearly a plant for America's corporatocracy. Yeah. And, you know, like, what? That's not a way to adjudicate anything. And we're only going to go careening fucking even harder into a wall without, like, really asking ourselves these questions. Do we need lifetime appointments? We need limitations on these terms. We need, or more justices, whatever it is. But it ain't working like this with the 3-6 mafia, 3 liberals and 6 conservatives. It ain't happening.
Yeah. The fourth most liberal member of the Supreme Court, Justice John Roberts, Crofton on the live show pointed out that he was part of, like, the basically the year 2000 version of the January 6th insurrection, but it actually worked, where they stormed where they were recounting votes in Florida. And he was part of what's called the Brooks Brothers riot, which you should look up if you. So that's who we're at a place where we're like, well, that's the best we can do other than the 3 liberal justices. So it's a real disaster. And hopefully, you know, somebody comes up with a thing to do up on that level, up on high. But I think to your point, just finding ways to get involved at locally is really kind of the only thing to do. All right, let's take another quick break and we'll come back and talk about McDonald's ice cream. And we're back. And when you're craving ice cream and you already happen to be inside of a McDonald's, nothing beats McDonald's ice cream. It's the best.
What a high bar.
For when you are physically within 6-foot radius of one of their machines. But the ice cream machine has, there's a problem with
the meme.
It's almost always broken. It's so widespread that as of last year, there was an app called McBroken that displays which locations have working ice cream machines. And so people were like trying to figure out why this is happening. McDonald's even started like doing self-deprecating tweets. They were like, we have a joke about our soft serve machine, but we're worried it won't work.
Oh boy.
It won't work.
Right. Thanks.
So
it won't work, huh? All right. Come on in.
So anyways, just a look at the sort of corporate glut that is the American economy. These are $18,000 ice cream machines. They're made by a company called Taylor, And basically, they are designed to be impossible for McDonald's employees to fix if they have any problem.
Yeah.
The menu options that you need to be able to just like figure out what the fuck is going on with the thing.
Just to even get to the menu.
Just basically. To get to the menu, you need no fewer than 16 button presses. Not even the owner's manual provides the code that you need to get like through those 16 button presses. It can't be accessed by McDonald's workers, only Taylor employees. So this is like, this is Taylor's way of like insulating themselves so that they always are needed by McDonald's. And
yes. It's like low energy, nonviolent mobsters.
Yeah.
Where it's like, oh, I hate for your ice cream machine to break. That's why you should call us up and get the protection package every week.
Press the cone icon on the screen of the Taylor C602 digital ice cream machine. Then tap the buttons that show a snowflake and a milkshake to set the digits on the screen to 5, then 2, then 3, then 1. After the precise series of no fewer than 16 button presses, a menu magically unlocks. Only with this cheat code can you access the machine's vital signs. So, yeah.
Do you guys remember when McDonald's used to aggressively advertise to what I guess they considered was the urban black community, where, you know, it would be like hip hop songs and, you know, people dancing with nuggets and like, you know, like and literally dancing and break dancing and whatnot? There's only one way to solve this. And to be honest with you, it's something that I'm kind of disappointed in all of us that have driven up to a McDonald's late at night, really just needing two, you know, really needing two of those Sundays. I'm disappointed that we haven't thought of it. The only way to fix this is if we start marketing to the Karen crowd, because the Karen crowd will take care of this shit. Like, I'll tell you right now, if they roll up to that McDonald's two consecutive times and it's not working, Taylor, McDonald's, whoever, someone's got to get on top of this.
Oh, you say there's low doses of ivermectin in the McFlurries at McDonald's. And they're like, I need them now. And they're like, sorry, miss, it's not working. And the next thing you know, they're uploading a viral TikTok video of them crying in their front seat with just like fucking captions going like, doo, doo, doo. I will be brave and get this McFlurry machine fixed. Yeah, I like that. That's good energy.
We could spread the rumor that people are not serving them on purpose because they're Karens. Like, that it's a meme. And like, that would really piss them off and like cause them to get to the bottom of this, I feel like.
Yeah. Well, this, the whole thing is just so funny, too, because, like, it's all, like, even though it's one of the things that a lot of people desire most, you'd figure at some point McDonald's would be like, hey, we're fucking losing money when these machines aren't working. And still they're caught in this relationship with Taylor where it's like, okay, I guess every store has thousands of dollars in repair bills because only Taylor can come and fix the fucking thing.
Yeah. So this is like part of it. This is a larger, like, issue throughout American.
Oh, yeah.
Businesses.
Consumers. Yeah.
Yeah. They just passed like a, or I think Biden's trying to get through a thing that's a right to repair thing that's just like, you should be able to fix your own stuff that you buy. And there shouldn't be like forced obsolescence and forced like technical problems that you can't fix so that you need to buy a new one or pay them.
Which I'm surprised because it's this, like, the lack of the right to repair that keeps the consumer machine humming and just people just tossing shit constantly.
Right.
It's like, oh, man, the volume button doesn't work on my TV. Out you go. And I'm like, what the fuck? I have a TV right now. It just doesn't turn on. And I'm, like, debating. I'm like, fuck, man, this shit costs money. Like,
yeah.
And even though I'm like, damn, cheap TVs are cheap, part of me is like, I just know someone can come in here, open it up, be like, oh, yeah, there's your problem. Bing! And then it's like a quick fix. But I also find myself in that same pattern of like, oh, shit doesn't work. Time to trash it and get a new one.
Yeah. So basically, Taylor charges franchises thousands of dollars a year for maintenance contracts. To like cope with this, two people like created their own like basically game genie for this fucking ice cream machine, a gadget the size of a small paperback book called Kitch, KYTCH. That hacks the machine and allows McDonald's employees to access it.
Hey.
Then Taylor hired a private detective to dig up. It's like all this betrayal and like espionage. And because like one of the people who is the head of equipment team for the National Supply Leadership Council sued them, there is now a Taylor Kitsch lawsuit, which has nothing to do with Taylor Kitsch, the actor. but they actually won a victory for like right to repair shit, which is right. kind of cool.
Well, because they completely misrepresented themselves. They were doing this shit where they would go like that. They would be like, oh, I'm just a franchisee owner. But there's a difference between a McDonald's owned franchise and just like an independently owned McDonald's.
Right.
And what they were doing was like they were pretending like, oh, yeah, I want to get one for my restaurant. And then like trying to hack this shit and do all this other stuff. And numerous people misrepresented themselves to Kitsch to try and get their hands on these devices and shit. And it right. just shows you like, what is the fucking like more than that? Why aren't they addressing their issue with Taylor? Like, don't come for Kitsch, who's just trying to make the ice cream flow. Because it's funny. I now I guess I want to go to my McDonald's and be like, yo, y'all have one of those fucking Kitsch things, huh? Because you right. always have fucking ice cream.
Yeah.
Like the other one that I used to go to North Hollywood, fucking never.
Right.
I remember the week McFlurries came out, this shit was a wrap. Like, it was just like, fuck it, bro. They like, right. it's almost like they just like blacked out the menu. Like, don't even fucking ask about that shit.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. So last month, Biden signed an executive order called on the Federal Trade Commission to institute rules to curb all anti-competitive restrictions that limit consumers' ability to repair gadgets on their own terms. But again, you know, that we got a Supreme Court and we're on the razor's edge in Congress with regards
to the Motorola razor's edge.
Exactly. With regards to just, you know, having a party in power that is fully in favor of, you know, the power of corporations over people. So,
but I don't know, I feel like this, you know, because like, you know, even Amy Coney Barrett sided with, you know, was like, no, the vaccine mandates, like, let those rock. There's part of me that feels like part of conservative culture would be like that there would be people just even in the base who are like, no, man, like I should be able to repair this shit because it doesn't feel like quite of a like a culture war battle.
Yeah.
You know, more than like something very practical. So I am curious to see how it goes, but I won't be surprised if they're like, we've sided with the computers.
All right. And finally, I do want to talk briefly just J.R. Smith's journey from being, you know, a meme, the meme of LeBron being very frustrated with him when he didn't know what the score was at the end of the best game that LeBron has ever played and kind of lost that game for them, to now being one of the internet's favorite human beings, human beings.
But first, we need to give people because not every, look, we know this, because I can't, we know not everybody listens, folks with them.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Jabari, Jack, do one of you want to set the table for people so they can understand like a quick primer into J.R. Smith to understand where we're going with this whole story? Because I want to make sure everyone because I think this is beautiful, but I have to make sure all the listeners buy in first.
I do just want to say J.R. Smith, like while I mentioned the meme thing, like that's purely me talking about like his perception within the social media landscape. Sure. Like anybody who makes it to the NBA and has a 16-year NBA career is like a one in a million, like gifted genius that like should be completely respected. But yeah, Jabari, why don't you had a tweet about just like kind of his journey.
Yeah. I mean, you know what? I'll reference that exact tweet. Anybody that basically goes from playing ball in New Jersey to making it to the NBA at all, let alone being an actual really good player, winning two titles, winning a sixth man of the year, having a stint in China midway through his career, when honestly, a lot of us thought like, oh, okay, well, that's going to be the rest of his career. Nope. Came on back, right. won titles after the fact. Mm-hmm. You know, that really is the American dream. And now he's 35 years old going back to college to compete in collegiate golf and live tweeting right. about his experiences in study hall and stuff like that. Like I can't think of a better story.
Yeah. He's some of his tweets about, yeah, so he's a great golfer and is going to be on the golf team and is like apparently a very fun teammate on the golf team, but he's just like a college student right now.
Yeah, and his tweets are fucking amazing.
Yeah.
Just like I'm just going to read a couple of them, right, from his first weeks of going back to college as a retired NBA player who just won a championship too the previous season. And now just trying to be a student, just trying to be low key, even though you're fucking J.R. Smith. He says, everyone around the city keep asking me, who you got doing your work? Shit, me, LOL. I'm really trying to learn something. The fuck? He's like, kind of like offended. Like, he's like, I'm really here. Yeah. First tutoring session in the books. I really like Mrs. Burke. Extremely helpful. You're like, all right, J.R. Smith. I like this. Next. Someone says, do you attend the dining halls for meals or do you cook from home? And he, quote, tweeted, responded. He said, I'm going to start learning how to cook. I'm way too old to not know how to learn how to at least cook 2 to 3 meals. That's just lazy. I'm like, it's like you're talking sense like our mothers would have been talking to us.
And then somebody was like, oh, what do you want to learn to cook? And he said shrimp Alfredo. And somebody was like, dude, that's like the easiest thing to cook in the world.
Yeah,
and I would have been like, shut the fuck up. But he was like, well, not for me. And just like,
yeah, I
mean, right.
Can you make 35 footers? Like right. Stop.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, after that shit with LeBron and the Cavs and that meme moment, I feel like he's got some thick skin. Someone's saying, Super Fritos. He's like, yeah, okay. Keep it moving. And then this other one I really love, he said, finish my English homework. Dope short story about a little girl with 6 brothers and seeking parental approval. Dope reading. And then a stack of books emoji. And I was like, he's loving it. And I love to see like this sort of, you know, when you see people kind of get this whole new energy about them rather than just being like, let me let the momentum dissipate of being in the NBA and being an athlete. And then I just kind of figure it out from there. He's like, no, I want to go get a degree. I want to learn. And I'm loving that, too.
Yeah. He's basically Rodney Dangerfield in Back to School, except for he was an NBA champion.
Exactly. Really? And I mean, somebody like asked their cousin if they, like, who goes to that college if they see him on campus? And they're like, yeah, all the time. He's legit, like, on campus constantly.
Yeah. Yeah, he's going to a historically black college, North Carolina A&T.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he's just got, it's also funny to see tweets of other students at the college be like, yo, let this man fucking live, okay? Like, you guys are mobbing him, and he's a student just like any of us trying to get his degree. And I'm like, I love it. I just love everything about this story where there's, like, other people who, like, I get it, he's here, and maybe it's a distraction, but also respect that he's also pursuing an education.
The fact that he's made it this far without, like, getting signed up for a reality show that is, like, following him around with a giant camera crew is impressive, because that's coming, or at least somebody is. He's having to turn down a lot of money to keep that out of this journey. He also said, so somebody was like, you got to sign up for intramural basketball. And he was like, facts. So could you imagine?
I mean, I will pay to see those.
Oh, my God.
If I show up to intramural and J.R. Smith is sitting there, it's like, come on, man. What are we doing here? I mean, I'm trying to play, but yeah.
I mean, in a way, like, I'm so competitive sometimes, I can see that turning into straight-up rage at J.R. Smith, because I'm like, you shouldn't be here. You're a fucking immortal, and it's not right. I'm just trying to fucking do me, and you're going to windmill on me? Are you fucking dumb? I don't need this.
Coke Miles coming back?
Yeah, Coke Intramurals Miles coming back.
What the fuck, man?
And man, that was a fucking foul, man! And I'm just, like, low-bridging him and shit. They're like, oh, my God, dude. This guy's fucking sick.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
What, like, when the worst guy on Georgetown would come to, like, run at, like, the gym where everybody played, like, and definitely the worst guy. It was just, like, night and day. Could you imagine somebody who was the best player on Georgetown, let alone the, like, one of the best players in the world, like, playing intramural basketball? Like, that would be...
Coming up, I played in the league based out of Tarzana Park. It was actually, you know, pretty competitive league. Like, at the time when Gilbert Arenas was in college, he played foolishly. And I can tell you what it feels like. I was one of those folks that I came up playing basketball, played high school, played, you know, traveling teams and whatnot. It was ARC. I absolutely did play ARC. You know, shout out to North Hollywood Games. But playing against guys that have it, it's night and day.
Yeah.
You don't belong on the court with them. So it's always funny to me when I see people on NBA Twitter talking about, oh, I could school that dude or I could do it. And honestly, really the funny part is when they're saying it about the WNBA, and it's like, do you know what those ladies would do to you? Like, do you have any idea?
There's videos of that.
Exactly.
Of shit talkers who step to WNBA players and just get fucking dusted, rinsed, put out to dry, folded, ironed, and then put back in the fucking drawer.
I got a buddy right now that still believes it. Like, since the WNBA started. Now, and this was a dude, you know what? He may listen to this. He was not as good as the rest of us. And he swears up and down. He swears up and down that he would absolutely destroy them. And I just, for the life of me, it's like, you're not even 6 foot.
Bless his fragile sense of masculinity.
I mean, that would be a ratings bonanza if they just scheduled games against people who swore up and down. They could be down and just watch those people's humanity just be fucking demolished.
I would love. Oh my God, it's a show called Fuck Around and Find Out.
Yeah.
And it's like pros versus Joes. But what we do is we put people in psyops, basically.
Right.
It's a psyop against these people being like, gas them up. Oh, you got them. We're pairing you up with somebody who ain't shit, bro. You're gonna fuck them up. And then we're really being like, okay, so you ready to fuck with Candace Parker?
Right.
Yep. Here you go.
You ready for this? You sure? Can you handle this? And then they just get destroyed and then come to them and be like, how was that? Sit down, sir.
As the game is playing, like on the Jumbotron, they're just playing like all their comments from earlier about how good they're going to be.
Right. You just get posted so easily. And then after every point, a shit talking thing has to go up. Oh, I got this in the post. Drop step, please.
Guys, I
got
to be honest with you. I think you guys are giving away gold here. I'm not joking.
It's pretty good.
It's just, because everyone wants to see a comeuppance, right?
Yeah.
And like, no. Nothing better than people who swing way out of their fucking weight class for shit and like gas themselves up on stupid shit, ignorance, and then be like, I think you're in need of a real practical lesson here.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Well.
Network scattered us.
Yeah, yeah. Jabari, it's been such a pleasure having you as always. Where can people find you and follow you?
I really appreciate you guys having me back. And like I said, I hope this is not a precursor to what will come on Tuesday.
Right.
Twitter's the easiest place. Jabari Davis, NBA. 19 Media Group is the group that I'm with. As Jack and Miles were both kind enough to mention earlier, Never Meet Your Heroes, as well as the NBA Baseline Pod. And you said active social media? I do, actually. I got two quick ones for you. So Nate Robinson, I'm sure that you guys saw, the Paul brothers, or maybe you saw the Paul brothers were, talking to Myles Garrett, talking mess and going back and forth. Nate Robinson jumped into the mix and, was trying to defend him. So someone's response to Nate Robinson was at Bashaw Saw said, good morning. It's been 10 months since your fight. For anybody that's not aware, Nate Robinson got knocked out in something so fierce in his fight. I like silly stuff like that. And then the other one was actually by a buddy of mine, at Dad Sham Dad, really good guy, politician Todd Wither, at GOP Todd. It was, kind of running his mouth, talking shit to somebody, saying, and dismissing them, saying, thanks. How many people voted for you to be one, the one that makes public policy? And my guy, at Dad Sham Dad, reminded him, hey, you ran unopposed, dumb shit.
Oh, man. Must be nice when you can just kind of assume you're famous, but also can assume nobody like pays any attention to you. So you can just make wild ass claims. That's great. Miles, where can people find you? What's the tweet you've been enjoying?
Find me Twitter, Instagram at Miles of Gray. Also, the other show, 420 Day Fiance. If you're fucking with a 90 Day and Weed, I mean, there's no better place. No better place to come on down for the fun times. Tweet that I like. Let's see. First one is just from John Levenstein, at John Levenstein tweeted, I can't say this hasn't crossed my mind, that a horse dewormer might make my poops nicer. and then Steve Hernandez, regular guest on the show, at Big Hearn tweeted, and it's just like this sort of conversation that happened on Twitter. He said, should I date someone that lives in Irvine? And then Alan Strickland Williams said, are they Irvine? And then someone was like, God damn it, Alan. And then someone else was asking like, no, you're married. And then Steve said, have you heard of Polly? Like polyamorous. And another person came in and said, yeah, and I hear she's bad news. It was just like a bunch of weird, stupid response. And I just, for local people, I like someone saying Irvine. And like, yo, are they Irvine? So stupid.
In line with that, Dan at Flawless Cowboy tweeted, shoddy bad, like morally. Two Black tweeted, rereading is underrated, which is just true. Dan Perlman tweeted, recently got drunk at a wedding and started a fun made-up rumor that I baked the cake. And then Steve again tweeted, two people having sex and they both have harmonicas in their mouths, which is just a great idea. You can find me on Twitter at Jack_O'Brien. You can find us on Twitter at Daily Zeitgeist. We're at The Daily Zeitgeist on Instagram. We have a Facebook fan page and a website, dailyzeitgeist.com, where we post our episodes and our footnotes.
Footnotes.
Where we link off to the information we talked about in today's episode, as well as a song that we think you might enjoy. Miles, what song are you sending people to today?
This is a track from an artist. Again, just so much good new music. China, C-H-Y-N-N-A. An MC from, I'm guessing, Philadelphia, because their profile says Slytherin, Philadelphia, Leo, Shy Fieri, because they're called China. So I'm really liking the the bio information. Nice. And the track is called 1.28.19. I'm guessing the date being January 28th, 2019. And it's just like, it's just got a nice, dark, kind of futuristic gutter rap production. It's kind of glitchy, and I just like her low energy flow, but it's like menacing too at the same time. I'm really liking all the new MCs that are coming out. So this is China with 1.28.19.
Nice. All right, go check that out. The Daily Zeitgeist is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. That is going to do it for us this morning, but we are back this afternoon to tell you what is trending. And hey, we'll talk to you all then. Bye.
Bye.